Economic Development, welcome on this 90-degree day in May, and too bad we don't have the sunroof open. I guess we don't have a sunroof in this room. Okay. Just to give you an idea, those of you who are here for different bills on our schedule today, we're going to go a little bit out of order. We are going to start with House Bill 2604, Senate Bill 955. We're going to do a few of the public hearings and work sessions on the House bills. We're going to get to Senate Bill 408 between 1:45 and 2, okay? So if you're at schedule, we'll try to keep to that so we don't unnecessarily hold you. So with that, open up a work session on House Bill 26048 and ask that Dave Hendricks come forward. Members, we have an A6 amendment in front of us. This is the real estate rewrite bill that we heard a number of weeks ago. And as you recall, we had some issues over two major parts of the bill that came up in hearing. One regarding advertising and the negligence standard, particularly on the negligence standard. And I asked Dave Hendricks, the legislative counsel, if he could meet with attorneys from the various sides and define what it is that we were doing. And Dave was kind enough to do that and asked him then if he could find some resolution to that. So, Mr. Hendricks, thank you very much. Could you maybe briefly explain the process that you and the different parties went through, who you worked with, and what the A6 amendment does?
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, acting legislative counsel. The A6 amendment addresses the issue of the disciplining of real estate agents by reason of negligence. The existing statute has negligence as one of the standards for disciplining real estate agents and certain other people engaged in real estate activity. The bill, as it's before you, House Bill 2604, had substituted gross negligence as being the standard for the disciplining of these professionals. And Senator Metzger had asked, Chair Metzger had asked that I meet with the attorneys, basically Christine Shute from the Department of Justice on behalf of the real estate agency, and Matt Farmer, who is the attorney for the real estate agents themselves or the organization, and to just talk about the legal standard and where the concerns were with the shift going from negligence to gross negligence. Gross negligence is a standard that's known in tort law that basically requires a higher standard of showing than just mere negligence, and frequently it's used in the context of whether or not you can get punitive damages against someone. The classic example of gross negligence that I always give is if you're driving on a street and you go through an intersection and you just neglect to see the sign, you run into somebody, you were probably negligent for failing to properly keep a lookout. If you do the same thing and you're drunk, probably gross negligence because you should not have been drunk and driving, and that's one of the classic examples given of gross negligence. Anyway, the concerns seem to boil down to, on the part of the licensees, the concerns seem to boil down to the perception that negligence could be used in a way that would basically allow the agency to make up rules as they went along as to what kind of conduct would be prohibited, that they would say, well, you were negligent here because you forgot to do something and therefore you should be disciplined, and they felt that that was not tied adequately to any standards out there with respect to the community at large. The Dash A6 amendments would basically tie that term, that doesn't even say negligence anymore, but it ties you back into what is, I believe, the fairly common understanding of what negligence is in tort law, where you're suing someone for making a mistake, which is basically that the conduct they engaged in is below the standard of care for the practice of professional real estate activity as established by the community of persons engaged in the practice of professional real estate activity. So the concept is, it's not necessarily, it's not what the agency thinks is good or bad with respect to negligence, but they look out to the community of real estate agents and say, well, what out there is it would be expected by the community general in general of people engaged in these activities as meeting the standard of what you should do in any given case. So This was a language that worked back and forth on, and you know, I'm going to leave that to the parties to discuss as far as where they're at on this, but this was what we came down to when we decided to put some language down on paper.
Thank you, Mr. Hendricks. Questions for Mr. Hendricks? Okay, thank you. Can we have a representative of the agency and a representative of the association come forward? Welcome. Please identify yourself, and if you could comment to the language in the A6 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Scott Taylor. I'm the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner. To comment on the dash sixes, I think Mr. Hendricks described the process accurately, as well as our understanding of the amendment, and we can support the amendment.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Jana Jarvis for the Oregon Association of Realtors. We can support the amendment as well.
Questions for the committee of either witness? Okay. Any? Thank you very much. Anybody else wish to comment on this before we move forward? Okay. We'll close. We'll dismiss you. We're in work session with an A6 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the A6 amendment to House Bill 2604.
Senator Starr has moved the A6 amendment to House Bill 2604. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2604 as amended to the Senate floor to pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2604 as amended by the dash A6 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Starr, you're an author of this bill. Would you like to carry that?
Sure.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Hendricks, for your hard work and all the parties. Okay, we are going to open a work session on Senate Bill 955. And, Teresa, this is the condominium bill that we had about a month or so ago.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair.
And... we have, who do we have for this today?
We have to do Brian DeMarco from the real estate agency, and Barry Pack is here as well, who's one of the proponents of the measure.
If we ask the two of them to come forward, that would be great. Okay. Welcome. We have a dash 5 amendment to this bill. Mr. DeMarco, I think maybe we'll start with you, your comments. Go to Mr. Pack and see what questions we have from the committee.
Sure. The agency initially had objections to the original dash amendment to this bill, and the chair asked that the parties get together and basically work things out. We met and did work things out. It was a productive session, and then I personally had some telephone calls with the one of the main proponents of the bill, and we cut to the chase on what exactly the proponents were looking for, and we revised the amendment so that I believe everybody's on board and well pleased with the final product.
Thank you. Mr. Pack, if you could tell us briefly about the amendment that we have and some of the key points on it in which changes from the bill that we originally saw.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Barry Pack, and I'm here with the Committee for the Protection of Condominium Owners and Builders. Long name. The bill you saw about a month ago dealt with liability and warranty periods for newly constructed condominiums and with some maintenance requirements. When we all sat down together to work out an agreement, what we boiled it all down to is to set aside the warranty and liability issues and focus instead on the maintenance requirements. And what we've reached is an amendment that amends both the planned community statute and the condominium statute, amends the reserve study section so that when a homeowners association or declarant who's building a condominium conducts the reserve study so that annually the homeowners association knows how much money they need to set into reserves for the maintenance. They do that based upon a plan for the maintenance. And then annually as those studies get reviewed, if there are any revisions, the new amendment would require that the homeowner or the declarant, the homeowners association or the declarant, notify the individual unit owners of any revisions that the board has made. So it's a gut and stuff of the original bill, and we focus solely on the maintenance question.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Starr.
The organizations at the table, can you just tell us who is part of this negotiation? And
sure.
Everybody's, I just want to make sure everyone is...
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr. At the table were my clients, a consortium of condominium builders, Brian DeMarco and Rich Vile with the Homeowners Association Working Group.
Okay, great, thank you.
And I would like, if I may, to thank Brian especially for his help through this process. He initially came up with the suggestion that we put this into the reserve study statute, which I think everyone agrees is a better place for it.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you for working on this issue. I appreciate it very much. Committee, we have a dash 5 amendment on 955.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
The dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 955.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 955. Further discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 955 as amended to Senate 4th due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 955 as amended by the dash 5 amendment to the 4th due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Sword. Would you like to carry this bill in particular?
Okay.
Okay. Senator Starr will carry the bill. Okay. We're going to move now to a public hearing. Okay. Let's go to a public hearing on House Bill 2071. And Teresa, would you give us just a brief background on this, and we'll ask Mr. Boyd and Mr.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2071 is brought to you by the Construction Contractors Board. It requires claimants to file a statement of claim with the Construction Contractors Board when they attempt to assess a licensee surety bond due to a court judgment or arbitration award issued pursuant to a contract dispute involving the work on a large commercial structure. It also requires the statement of claim accompany the copy of the judgment or award sent to the surety company. It came out of the House Business and Labor Affairs Committee with a 5-2 vote, and on House floor passed 56-0.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Senator Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Bill Boyd. I'm the manager of the Dispute Resolution Program for the Construction Contractors Board. Craig would normally have been here, who's the administrator, but he had to be in Portland today. And this next to me is Christy Patton, who is actually, she's the manager of our licensing section, and she is mainly here on 2200, but we just figured we'd end up both up here at the same time. She's going to help if I get into trouble on 2200. This bill is a small amendment to the program that we have for submitting claims for large commercial structures. Those claims are submitted in a very different way than for claims involving residential structures. The large commercial structure claims are submitted by filing the claim in court and then submitting a copy of that court complaint to the surety company involved and to the Construction Contractors Board. One of the problems that has arisen over the years is that sometimes we have trouble determining just on the basis of the complaint whether we have jurisdiction, and the surety company has trouble determining whether they were the surety on involved in that work for the period when the work was done. And so this bill just asks that the same time that you submit that complaint from the court, that you submit a form that indicates has enough information for both the surety and for the CCB to determine what it needs to do to determine whether it has jurisdiction over the claim, or for the surety to determine whether it's the bond at risk. It's particularly important for the surety companies because they only have 30 days to indicate that that they were not the surety company that was involved, and otherwise then they become the surety whether they were the surety at the time or not.
Okay.
Nothing to add.
Questions of the committee? Okay, thank you. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2071? I think it's pretty straightforward. Nobody else? Then we'll close public hearing on House Bill 2071 and open a work session on House Bill 2071.
Okay.
Senator Starr.
Move the bill to Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2071 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. I'll go. Well, Senator Montes Anderson, why don't you carry this? We need to, you know, mix that health care and business together.
Definitely.
Okay. So, take that off. Now we're going to go to a public hearing on House Bill 2200 and ask for the second rendition. Yeah. Welcome again.
Thank you. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, do I need to introduce myself again?
Yes.
For the record. My name is Bill Boyd. I'm the manager of the Dispute Resolution Section for the Construction Contractors Board. Sitting next to me is Christy Patton, who is the manager of the Licensing Section for the CCB. 2200 is a bill that was designed to just reorganize. Over the years, this licensing statute built up and little pieces were tacked onto it, and they weren't very well organized, and so it was designed, started out as a bill to reorganize the bill and to also clarify some questions that arisen over time regarding the education and testing requirements and some of the other licensing requirements. And so what this bill does is it puts things more in the order of chronological order, in the order that a party would encounter the different sections of the bill as they went ahead and applied for a license, got licensed, applied for to renew that license, and so on. It also specifies, takes care of some clarification of some items. It specifies when employment account numbers are required. It defines what names and addresses that a new applicant must provide for us. We've had a voluntary four-year license. Normally it's a two-year license, but a person can sign up for a four-year license. That has proved to be very difficult to administer, and so we're going to eliminate that. And finally, a party can go in to put their license on inactive status, and which means that they don't have to have insurance and they don't have to have a bond during that period. But we didn't define when that inactive status starts, and so this bill takes care of that. And finally, we have a bill, a statute, ORS 701.102, in which we hold contractors accountable, the individuals involved in businesses accountable for what the business does. And there's nothing more frustrating to a Oregonian than to have a contractor cause them some damage, come in, do some work, not be able to pay for to have the work redone correctly, and then find that contractor working, 6 months later on another project, and yet they've left this unpaid debt. And so we have for a long time had this disciplinary procedure that says that if you're the officer of or an owner, excluding passive investors, but otherwise you're an owner or an officer of a business, a construction business, that owes unpaid orders or unpaid construction judgments or has had their license revoked and had a fine that's gone unpaid, then you will not be able to get your business, start up another business and get that a license there until you take care of those unpaid judgments. And we've had that statute for a long time. The way that it's been written, and I have to take some responsibility for this because I was involved in redrafting it about three sessions ago, it was very difficult to understand it. And so we have rewritten it so that it's more in plain English. Sometimes lawyers don't speak in plain English, and so that's...
I know. I'm learning.
So we think it's in plain English now, and we did that by defining some terms and then using those definitions in a much shorter, straight, direct statement that's in the redrafted 701-102. That's not changing the policy as we've been applying it for years. It's just making it easier to understand so that we can explain it and so citizens can read it and understand what it is. I think that's all of the major points of this bill. So if you have any questions, we're ready to answer them.
Okay. I'll ask the committee. Have some questions. Senator Starr.
Thank you. I'm interested in the move from doing away with the four-year license. What's the issue on the administrative side that caused that to be difficult? It seems to me that would be more convenient for license holders. But what's the issue there, really?
Senator Metzger, Senator Starr, I would like to have Christy answer that question.
Yeah, thank you. We license business entities rather than actual individuals. In many cases, the business entity may choose to change their business entity within that four-year period, when they change their business entity, possibly for tax purposes or for whatever reason that they choose to change, they are required to get a new license. We then have extra years on this license, and they want a refund. Then we have to determine whether we're going to refund that extra portion, prorate it. It just becomes administratively difficult. It's difficult to project revenue. It's just a difficult thing for us to administer.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Have you had requests from your licensees that this is a problem? How many contractors does CCB currently administer?
Total?
Mm-hmm.
About 40,000.
And how, and Mr. Chair,
yes.
How many of those change there? I mean, I guess I'm getting to an issue of really what is the, how many of them change their business status in a 2-year period?
We have approximately 60 a month.
60 a month.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's 360. 720. I read your mouth. Read your lips. You're right. Quickly doing the math in my head. 720 in a year out of 40,000. So you're going to change the law to accommodate 720, really to accommodate you, dealing with 720 when you have 40,000 people that your licensees out there.
What's your thinking?
Well, I'm just my thinking is that a four year license is more convenient for the business than having to come in every 2 years to renew their license, and we're changing the law to accommodate the agency because they got 700 or so businesses that are changing their thing every year. So I don't know.
You want a response to that?
Well, this was part of what we felt that it would make the agency just run a little bit smoother, and it just seemed like it was not that big of an imposition to ask everybody to have just a 2-year license. I don't really know of too many licenses where you're given an option. Like if you renew your driver's license, you don't get to choose what period you. You just sort of take whatever they give you. That was the. It's an extra expense that I didn't think that the agency should have to bear.
A follow up.
Yeah.
The contractors have a choice to do a. What kind of choices do they have? A 1-year, 2-year, 3-year, 4-year. What's the choice that they have?
It's a 2-year license.
2-year mandatory.
A 2-year and a possible 4-year. There's no contractors that are here to testify.
Yeah. Is there any contractors in the audience who'd like to comment on that issue? Anybody would like to be a contractor who would like to comment on that issue? Are you comfortable with that?
Yeah.
Laura, do you have any questions?
No.
Okay. Then, since we have no contractors to comment on the 2-year versus the 4-year, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2200 and open the work session on House Bill 2200. Senator Starr.
Move on House Bill 2200.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2200 to the floor with a new pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So I guess I'll carry that once my turn. So we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2579. Don Minor and Ted Hughes, the dynamic duo, or at least a solo. I don't see Mr. Hughes here.
That was an or.
Oh, that was an or. Okay. Oh, I see. You guys are just interchangeable.
I'm be here. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Minor. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of House Bill 2579 and ask for your support as well. Last legislature transferred responsibilities for regulating manufactured home dealers from DMV to the Building Codes Division. It appears there was a sort of a glitch in that law. Dealers are required, that needs to be corrected. Dealers are required to purchase a 3-year license. The transfer occurred on May 1, so up until May 1, they were required to purchase their license from DMV. the 2003 legislation that passed said that that license would be good until it expired, or January 1, whichever came first. And so that appears to have been a mistake. What this legislation would do is say that the license is good until it expires. It shouldn't have a fiscal impact. Our understanding is that DMV prorated the licensing fees that it collected so that if they sold a license on April 1st, they would keep 136 and remit the 3536 to the Building Codes Division. So essentially, it just it allows dealers to use their license until it expires. I request your support.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Meyer?
Oh, and I have testimony.
Okay. And stay close by Joan Frazier, DCBS. Thank you. Welcome.
Well,
give us your thoughts on House Bill 2570. Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joan Frazier. I'm with the Department of Consumer and Business Services Building Codes Division. And we have a bill with exactly the same information coming to you, I hope, next week on this dealer issue. We had an agreement with Mr. Miner and with the counties. We had some technical issues that we needed to resolve. Mr. Miner and Building Codes Division discovered this problem with the dealers. We wanted to resolve that. And the counties had some technical issues they also wanted to fix. So we do have a bill that I'm hoping that will come before you in 2389 that you're going to recognize has the same language as this. So obviously we would support this fix.
Okay. And it's the exact same language currently that you know of?
I believe it is.
Okay.
Okay. It shouldn't be any conflicts or differences.
And where is that one in the process right now, Mr. Reiner?
In your committee.
It's in our committee.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. All right. Then we may get to it and may not, so I guess we better move ahead. Any other questions? Okay, then let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2579 and open up a work session, House Bill 2579.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
2579 to Senate floor through pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2579 to the floor through pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Order. All right, I'll go back to Senator Starr now for this bill to carry. Okay. Now, let's see, Mr. Fuller has number I get, so. Okay, we're doing well on time. Let's hope that we can keep this with this next bill. So we'll open up public hearing on House Bill 2069. Ask that Michael Snyder and Bill Cross come forward. Well, we wouldn't want that bill anyway.
Which bill are we doing?
2069. And as we are speaking, they are approaching, trying to beat the clock before we move to the next bill. Welcome. Go ahead and start.
Chair Metzger, my name is Michael Snyder. I am the administrator for the Landscape Contractors Board, and I thank you for the opportunity to come before you and talk about House Bill 2069 and answer any questions you have about it. The bill, just to give you a brief summary from my testimony that I've given to you, is the bill has several aspects to it that are of significant importance to the Landscape Contractors Board. One is that we are trying to create an inactive license. We don't have that ability now in our statutes to create inactive licenses for those that want to, individuals and businesses that want to go to an inactive status. The bill also increases the amount of bond that's required of landscaping businesses by, in a stepped fashion. We currently have is a $3,000 bond. Landscape projects can range anywhere from $100 up to $250,000 or even more, million-dollar projects today. The bond was established back in the 1970s and hasn't been changed since. We're asking for a stepped bond increase based on the amount of the contracts that are being done by the landscaping businesses. So if they do a larger contract, they would have to have a larger bond. We are after some increased consumer protection by having the board ability to suspend licenses for those businesses that let their insurance lapse or don't have their bond in effect. There's a consumer protection issue where they may be operating without the insurance and the bond in a 21-day period. To have a hearing for that leaves the consumer out there unprotected for that 21-day period, so we would like to have an emergency clause for that. The bill also allows the repair of backflow assemblies for those that have the tester certification from the Department of Health, and also lets plumbers do repair of piping for irrigation systems. We also are after the continuing education requirement. Currently, the board's position on continuing education is that we have an exam today that is made up of questions that comes from the industry and from the public membership that is not being audited by anybody on the outside. And so one of the strategic planning goals of the board was to get this exam certified through a national association that certifies and audits the process for administering licensing and certification exams throughout the nation. Part of that requirement for getting that certification is to have a recertification program in place, and that gave us a choice of either retesting those applicants and licensees in a periodic time intervals or to do continuing education. And continuing education is much more popular and easier to administer. And then we also have some housekeeping issues around the difference between landscape businesses and landscape contractors. It's a confusing issue in the statutes, and we're trying to clean that up through some of the housekeeping things we have in the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Cross?
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, I am Bill Cross. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. I've submitted written testimony in favor of the bill and in favor of its passage. The industry looked at the different provisions that the board had identified before they even crafted the legislation and talked to the Landscape Contractors Association about those concepts. And we did a survey in the summer with our members who are reflective of, from the larger landscape contractors to small contractors, geographically diversified around the state, and basically had very good support for increasing the bond levels. They haven't been increased for years, and there is a consumer protection issue out there for requiring some continuing education requirements to help validate the licensing tests that we have in this state, and to frankly improve or increase the or enhance the professionalism within the industry, and to also support some of the other provisions in terms of the ability to suspend a contractor that may have three charges or complaints filed against them in a 12-month period, to assure then that we've got the opportunity to address issues that may be deriving out of that individual's business practices. So we're very supportive. I do know there are some amendments that have been presented to eliminate the, I call it a code of ethics provision in the bill. That's not something that, we looked at that. We are supportive. We don't view that, however, as critical to the bill. However, the other provision to eliminate the ability of the board to approve continuing education units would be viewed as critical. We have a licensing test, as Mr. Snyder explained, that isn't validated by anyone other than the board. We believe it does need to have the integrity that a certification, national certification, validifying the test, so that presumably if somebody fails, we've got the ability to say, wait a minute, it's a valid test. You either need to study more and retake it or find a different career. But we need that validation. And if continuing education is one of the requirements, we've been told that that can be, continuing education can be approved by attending trade shows, industry demonstrations, when a Rain Bird comes out with new irrigation systems, that type of, I mean, that there are many online education. I mean, there are many different forms because we do have members geographically challenged, so to speak, that might not be able to attend, you know, some classes being offered. So we are sensitive to that. We've talked to the board about it. They've indicated their flexibility in trying to provide the broadest avenue for those continuing ed, and we would really resist amending that out of the bill.
Okay, so we have a dash 2, dash 3, and dash 4, and the dash 2 essentially deletes the conduct, the ethics issue, as you call it. The dash 3 would eliminate the educational requirements, and the dash 4s would eliminate it all. So two are split and one's together. That's okay. Questions for this panel? Yeah, Senator Atkinson.
Go ahead.
Okay, Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there would the landscapers report their continuing education to the board? Is that what you require? Is there going to be fees?
Chair Metzger, Senator Mona Sanderson, the landscape contractor would have to submit the continuing ed. There would be no fees charged by the board for the continuing ed requirement. That's part of their licensing fees that we have in place already. We're not anticipating charging any fees on our side of the picture for continuing ed. We would be in a position to approve programs that would be allowed for the continuing education requirements.
Follow up?
Yes.
So they could report this online to you?
We would allow that to happen, yes.
Thank you.
Correct.
Thank you. Who's on the board now?
Chair Metzger, Senator Atkins, we have...
Atkinson.
Atkinson, excuse me. The board is made up of 7 members, 5 of which are industry-related members and 2 are public.
Are the industry larger landscape contractors? Are they smaller? Are they all in Portland? Are they scattered from around the state? Where are they from?
We gather them from all over the state. We have the chairs from Medford. Would be a small business. We have one in Eugene. It's a very small business, sole proprietorship. We have two in Portland. One's a tree care business on top of being landscape contractors, is a sole proprietorship. We have another one that is in Portland, is a larger company. So we have a variety.
I'm a little skeptical of a board making up continuing education credits. Because in my experience that sometimes boards can put barriers to entry for smaller people who want to get in the industries, and they always use the guise of consumer protection and makes the industry look better. We went through this about 4 years ago on the used car dealers, and I got to tell you, I've regretted that ever since. Because what were happening in the used car dealers was keeping some other people out of the industry or whatnot. And I've actually done quite a bit of reading about this. When the government sets up a board, gives it the complete weight of the state government, namely in construction contractors is a great example, flooded by very large contractors who keep rules in place to keep small guys out or keep them out from being competitive. So it's just a red flag. I'm not saying that's what your intent is. I'm just... general philosophy, it's where I'm at right now. So how do you respond to that?
Chair Metzger, Senator Atkinson, the exam is the arbiter in whether a person gets into the landscape industry. That is the first barrier that they have to overcome to get in. Continuing education, once they do that exam, they have shown to the board satisfaction a minimal level of competency to do the work that we're giving them a license for. What we're after is that exam is a one-time shot, and education continues and learning continues, and there's many aspects of landscaping that are changing. Water issues are continually changing. Planting techniques are changing. Soil conditions, how soil science conditioning, changing. Business practices are changing. And we would like to be able to ensure that those things are happening, plus have our exam certified.
By whom?
By the National Organization of Accreditation Certification. They're a national organization that looks through all the ways that an exam is administered. How is the exam constructed? On what basis is it constructed? You have to submit all the parts of the exam process. We have an exam committee that is now very active in breaking down all the levels, the skills, the functions that are done in the landscape process from the day of designing to the final signing of the contract to the actual doing of the work. Those functions are listed, and questions and those things are weighed about into importance, and those questions are based on that functionality. It's a hard, long process to do. It costs a significant amount of money to do that, but it is something that's important to make sure that the exam is relevant and is dealing with issues of competency.
Thank you. Question I have is comparing, and I wish that the representatives from the CCB were still here. Compare what you have in this bill as is what the state requires of construction contractors boards licensees. My experience is there's no continuing education there, and I'm not sure that their testing is any way nationally accredited either. But can you
sure, I'd be happy
that?
To. Chair Metzger and Senator Starr. There's two different construction contractors are different in their licensing than ours, because there's two licenses required for landscape contracting in the state of Oregon. Construction contractors, their exam is a business exam. It has nothing to do with competency. They're not testing people on how to build houses, or how to build decks, how to do anything in that construction. You can go there and take a 16-hour class on business practices, liens, how to write a contract, and you can go out and build a house. Primarily because everything that they do is done by permit. They pull a permit to pour the foundation, they pull a permit to do the framing, the electrical, whatever else, and it gets inspected. Landscaping doesn't have that privilege. There's no permit process. So what we have in our system is we do an individual comes in and gets tested on the competency. Now that person cannot, they get what we call an individual landscape contractor's license. It's a misnomer in the statute, but it's hard to change. The entity that actually does the contracting is the business. And so that individual landscape contractor either has to be an owner of or an employee of a licensed business. And he or she is supposed to supervise all the work that is being done in that business. So, and there's no permits pulled except for the backflow device, and that's a plumber's process, and so we have to fulfill all those codes for that. But when you're doing soil preparation, when you're planting, putting in drainage, putting in plants, there is no permit pulled, and so nobody comes out and inspects it. So we are giving a license based on a person demonstrating what we consider a minimal level of competency to go out and do that work without having it further inspected by anybody.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this group? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. McDermott, and we have a number of people with Mr. McDermott, so if Mr. McDermott, if you want to bring a couple of folks up.
I wonder if you give me time.
Okay. Since we're all kind of on the same point, I think you are, we'll try to keep to that point here. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello. I'll get started. My name is Brian McDermott. I'm from Senator Charles Starr's office. I'm coming to you with the amendments, the -2s, -3s, and -4 amendments. I have a handout. This was brought to our attention by small business, and I'm just going to kind of go through and briefly touch on what the amendments do, and then I'm going to let those who work in the industry explain the reasons for it. The amendments were to change the continuing education requirement, remove that from the bill, as well as remove the standards of conduct portion from the bill. And the main reason I would say for removing that is to remove the controversial part from the bill. We realize that a lot of small businesses have difficulty with that portion of the bill, and so the amendments are to remove that. That can be addressed based on its own merits, and then the other portions of the bill can be discussed based on those merits. I had heard of the bill as being a housekeeping bill, and so when it came to our attention, I reviewed it to see what was contained in the bill, and specifically that section 17 on page 10 was brought to my attention. I believe that's more than housekeeping. That's a pretty sweeping change, and that debate needs to be held, but not in the context of a housekeeping bill.
Okay.
Let's see. I've got a couple of notes, and I'm just going to just bring up a few points and then turn it over to them. We believe the standards of conduct should be addressed through the industry association. And I have a printout here. I'll just show it to you. I had printed one copy for each of you, but it's 167 pages. This is put out by the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, and it's titled Oregon Landscape Guidelines. And just thumbing through it, I saw some real good things in that, and I think that's the place of industry associations. So that's one point that I wanted to make sure I made. As far as continuing education, we can make the tests better if that's the goal. We can make it better without requiring continuing education. That's not a necessity for improving the test. Those two portions of the bill, the portion that allows continuing education, section 17, subsection 2, it gives the board the authority to set fees, and that is not in any way restricted. Those fees could be any number. It's basically unlimited, and so we'd like to see this controversial portion of the bill to be amended so that the bill itself can be discussed based upon its merits. And I'll turn it over to them to talk about it.
Real quickly, Chair and Committee, I'm Wes Butler. I'm from Silverton. I've been in the landscape industry for 30 years in two states. I've been licensed since 1980. I've been a lot of places and done a lot of things. And with regard to this industry, it's very costly for the six of us that are here to be here. This is our harvest time, and when it hits, it hits. We thought it important enough to come down and encourage these amendments to the bill. I wish we had more time to go in depth with the rest of it, and we have serious concerns about the direction that regulation is going in our industry. And Oregon is one of the highest regulatory states in terms of the landscape industry. I'll say just in general terms, because I haven't checked totally and completely, landscape architects are pretty generally regulated throughout the 50 states. Landscape contractors generally have to get just a business license. So I guess what I wanted to say is that the test here in Oregon, coming from California, I will say that it is far more than adequate to test a man's knowledge or woman's knowledge in terms of this industry. It is, I would say, prohibitive to a guy that just wants to go put sod in, somebody that wants to go fix sprinkler heads, I would say that the test currently is prohibitive to small business. And I have great concerns in that area, and I intend to address those in the future. But I'm going to let Mike Schrock talk here, and thank you for your time, and thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
My name is Mike Schrock. Just want to say thank you for allowing me to share with you today, Senator Metzger's and members of the board. My name is Mike Schrock. I'm one of those small business contractors. I have about 4 employees, and I'm one of those types of guys that's out there with my men digging in the dirt and whatnot. And when I heard about the new regulations that they were trying to do through this bill, I was very concerned because I thought, you know what? I'm a family man. I want to work hard. I want to go to my kids' basketball game at the end of the day. And now the state is coming in and saying, we want to add some more upon you. We want you to take some classes. Well, I've taken classes. In order to have a license to be able to spray chemicals, I had to go and pass a 300-question test to do that. And then I had to go through continuing education. And I found out what the continuing education was like. Basically, you sign up for various classes, and they really don't even have to be relevant to what you're doing. The fact was, we sprayed so few chemicals, it was so irrelevant to what we had to do, but I had to take all of these classes. One of the questions was, what is the charges? What are the fees? There aren't any fees put out by the contractors board. No, there's not fees there. But there are fees when you count my time away from my business, when you count my time, the amount that it costs to take these classes, and then who determines what classes you take. Of all the classes I took for the chemical classes, I can probably tell you only one thing I learned in all the classes I ever took, because most of the stuff was irrelevant to our industry and what I was doing. Who's going to regulate the classes? Who's going to say what they need to be? That's one of the questions that I have. Probably even a bigger issue for me is the concern over the issue of establishing standards of professional conduct for landscape contractors. Who determines what these standards are? I went to one of the classes that they may be referring to put out by OLCA, the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, several years ago. I went to one of the pruning classes, and they put a tree up there, and they said, okay, now, how would you prune this tree? Well, there was about 100 landscapers in the room, and there was about probably 80 different points of view on what was right. Landscaping is a very subjective field of study. And so to say, well, we're going to have uniform standards and force everybody to take classes, it's so subjective. Every person that looks at a particular landscape, somebody's going to say this looks great. Somebody else is going to say this looks terrible. And what I try to do is I try to determine what does my customer want. I'll let my customer determine what is right and what is wrong. And if my customer does not agree with what I'm doing, then I'm going to be out of business. I've been in business since about 1988, and so those are a couple of things that I just want you to consider. I encourage you to consider that this issue of establishing professional standards within the industry, there is no agreement on what those professional standards are, number one. And then the continuing education, it just is going to take time, money, and for the little guy like me, I'm just the four-person employer. This tends to favor the larger employers because, see, when you have only 4 of us, when you take one guy away who's the leader, then it's a big deal. It's not such a big deal when you have 50 employees and one guy goes away to take classes. But for me, it is a big deal. I just don't have time to break away and go to classes all the time.
Thank you. I'm going to note we have, and it's hard sometimes to read these things, it looks like a Mr. Padilla, Ulibarri, Sedlak, and Hope signed up on the same issue. Do I have nods? Yeah, I agree with that. Is that okay? Any questions of this group? Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Cross, briefly, would you come back forward for a moment? Ms. Cross, we have a lot of things in this bill, and we have had discussion on Section 17, Items 2 and 3. And my question of you would be, is this bill important enough to you to move forward without Sections 2 or 3? Because we have a problem otherwise.
Well, I would like an opportunity to work with the committee and maybe some of the opponents on the continuing education. I totally agree and would support, and I've talked to the board, or Mr. Snyder, about eliminating the references to the board itself providing continuing education, charging fees for it. That wasn't, and that's not an important part of the bill at all. Maybe there's a way to put in here some, they approve of, you know, I don't know what the minimum hours would be a year in certain professions, because I'm certified as an association executive, and I have to do 6 hours a year of continuing ed to maintain my certification. Well, maybe there's a way we put in, you know, here's a minimum continuing education requirement, and the types of opportunities for continuing ed would include, you know, industry demonstrations or, you know, equipment demonstrations or things other than the, and, you know, things like online presentations, things that aren't, that are geographically conducive to very economical use of people's time. We have a lot of small contractors who are members of OLCA, and I can tell you that they wouldn't, the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, sorry, and they wouldn't, they're not interested in going from around the state to Portland for a six-hour class. They would like to get continuing ed. And so I guess if there's a way to...
I got where you are. Here's the deal. Here's it. I'm just going to tell you where we are, okay? We can move this bill with the dash four amendments, or we don't move the bill, and I can give you until our last meeting Tuesday morning. And if we don't make it, we don't make it. I mean, that's just, I'm being candid with you. You don't have votes for, you have the votes for this bill with that deleted. You don't, we don't have them otherwise. You may be absolutely right, Mr. Cross. So I'm not arguing that. I'm telling the reality of the committee at the moment. And so the rest of the, that's why I asked about the rest of the bill, because I think, you know, that's in jeopardy at the moment. I don't know if there's other vehicles that are currently in play that would allow you to continue that discussion in another vehicle, which I would recommend. Or I am willing to hold the bill, and I can't guarantee we'll have time on Tuesday, but I am willing to do that for you if you think you can work on this, and I'm happy to do that for you. Or I believe the committee is willing to move the bill with the dash four.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I empathize regarding the continuing education, and I would definitely be voting to eliminate continuing education. But I want to just talk a little bit about professional conduct. I mean, we just had a bill with the Realty Board where they have a lot of conduct, and I'm looking at this from a consumer protection issue regarding, I don't think the landscapers here are there, but there are certain sort of standard conduct that that won't jeopardize the consumer, and I would assume that that is what we're talking about regarding conduct, and something that wouldn't even affect these people because they're probably going to do excellent work.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments at the moment?
I think that there's a lot of that's in this bill is positive that needs to happen, and I'd hate to see it not take place just because we hold the bill over and don't have time to do it next week. You know, there's the plumbing piece of this bill, I think, is critical. Some of the bonding pieces in this bill are critical. And I think that, you know, we've got some concerns about and maybe an overreach of the agency and on another area that I think we feel pretty strongly about on the committee. But I think there are pieces in this bill that are really important to become law.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, may I? This is not the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association's board, and I think it would be appropriate to ask Mr. Snyder, because it's a landscape contractors board bill, I'd rather him indicate to you or respond to your question.
Please. And we're about done with this bill, time-wise, so you've got... Sorry, but that's
well,
the way it is.
Mike Snyder, Landscape Contractors Board. I want to move the bill ahead.
Okay. Close public hearing on House Bill 2069. Mr. Cross, I want you to know that I think your points are very valid. I'm looking at the broad picture here at the moment. So I'd like to have that discussion continue.
Yeah, I appreciate your consideration.
A work session on House Bill 2069.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the A4 amendments to Senate Bill 2069.
Senator Starr has moved the A4 amendments to House Bill 2069. Further discussion?
Yes. I will oppose this. I'll vote just because I do really feel there should be consumer protection. So I would have gone with, I think, whichever amendment it was that would have left the consumer protection piece in for code of conduct.
Thank you for coming. Any other comments? Any other objections besides Senator Montes Anderson on the amendment? So ordered.
Chair, I move House Bill 2069 as amended to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2069 as amended by the A4 to the floor to do pass recommendation. Further discussion? We take the roll, please.
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Deckard?
Excuse.
Yes.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Chair Metzger?
Aye. House Bill 2069, as amended, has been passed a 4-2 pass recommendation. Senator Starr, you're kind of our expert in this field, so I want you to carry this bill.
Okay.
Okay. Now, we're going to open up public hearing. Well, we've scheduled a work session on Senate Bill 408, but I have asked for people to sign up, and we do need Dexter, so we'll get legislative counsel in here. I think I'll start by asking Mark Nelson and Jeff Bissonette to come forward, if they're here. I know maybe we're moving too quickly for them. They're outside. So let's stand at ease for a sec until we get everybody back in the room. 408. Mr. Nelson, welcome. As we get organized here, Mr. Bissonette. Senate Bill 408, colleagues, we heard quite a while ago in its original form, which was dealing with rates of public utilities, and we did change that bill to the Warm Springs bill for a while. Well, now we have it back with the same original topic, but with different amendments going back to our original topic. And when Mr. Johnson from Legislative Council gets here, we'll have him walk through, which is essentially the new bill. In fact, here he is now. And I'll ask Mr. Johnson to come forward and to kind of walk us through the engrossed Senate Bill 408 amendment that has been completed. Go through that, and then we'll begin with testimony from Mr. Nelson, Mr. Bissonette, and others. So welcome, and I'm going to apologize to Mr. Johnson. He was up all night long working on this again, so we do appreciate that. Mr. Johnson, welcome, and if you could walk us through the bill that we have before us in the Dash A7 amendment.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. The amendment is basically a gut and stop of the bill, so I'll just concentrate on the amendment. And basically, Section 2 is the first substantive section of the bill, and it is a findings and declarations piece. It's fairly self-explanatory. It describes the concerns regarding how taxes are the current practices regarding taxes and how the costs for taxes are determined for rate making purposes, and expresses the legislature's concern with those practices. Section 3 is basically adds a definition of tax to the public utility chapters. It is a broad definition that includes income taxes and any other excise, essentially, that a public utility would or any other entity would pay on behalf of a public utility to a unit of government, whether it's federal, state, or local. Section 4 is really the guts of the amendment. It provides basically in subsection 1, it provides a direction that the utility should a little paperwork problem here that a utility may not collect more through rates than it pays in ultimately it or if it's a member of an affiliated group, the group pays in taxes. Subsection 2 establishes a new reporting requirement that utilities must file a tax report with the Public Utility Commission that sets forth certain tax information that the utility has basically concerning taxes that the utility has paid during the previous fiscal year. I want to note here that that does not is not tied to tax years. So if you're paying as a utility or an affiliated a parent of the utility, if you are paying taxes as a result of an audit from a prior year or estimated taxes for a future year, those are all treated the same, and refunds are subtracted out from that. If you file an amended return as a utility and get a refund, that's a minus. So it really looks at the actual dollars that are paid during the previous, during the utility's fiscal year. The commission then directs in subsection 3, the report is a public document.
And just if I interrupt just for a moment, Mr. Johnson, so this was an issue when discussing this, to make it clear. This is not their income tax forms that they will be providing the commission, but rather a report that will contain the information that they will certify.
That is correct, Chair Metzger. It is not the income tax returns themselves. It is other information. There's some direction here as to what the information is precisely, but also there's authority to the PUC to establish other information that the commission determines is useful to be reported on that return on that report. Subsection 3 directs that the report be made public. And subsection 4, which is really the core of this whole amendment, I'll go through a little bit more detail, directs the commission to review the report and make a determination as to whether there the amount of taxes assumed in the rates that the commission has authorized. If that amount of taxes is greater than the amount of taxes actually paid for any one of three previous fiscal years, then it directs that the utility establish what's called an automatic adjustment clause in the rates that are approved by the commission. And the automatic adjustment clause is essentially kind of an automatic adjustment to rates to take into account this difference between the amount collected and the amount actually paid either by the utility or by the affiliated group of which the utility is a member. Then subsection 5 is a bit of an exception from that rule. There currently is something that is authorized in rates called deferred taxes, which are taxes that are collected that are not paid and are instead put in a deferred account, and it is to basically take into the account that utilities may claim accelerated depreciation on certain depreciable property. The effect of accelerated depreciation is that you get a larger deduction earlier on, and eventually it switches over and you get a smaller deduction than you otherwise would. And these deferred taxes are designed to be the source for paying the tax when the depreciation deduction is smaller than it normally would be. This is a current practice, and subsection 5 preserves that practice. Subsection 6 is another exception. Basically allows the commission to not require that an automatic adjustment clause be attached to the rates if the commission determines that it is causes a materially adverse effect on customers of the utility. And that material adverse effect is a defined term. Actually, you will see that lines 18 through 21, and it sets forth with some precision the those situations in which the commission determines that in fact this is a negative consequence for ratepayers, then it will not require the automatic adjustment clause to be put into place. Section 5 is an amendment to existing law, essentially to include costs for taxes in the definition of automatic adjustment clauses, which is set forth in 757.210, and it makes consistent the standard of fair, just, and reasonable that appears elsewhere in the draft. And Section 6 is the effective date, which is an emergency clause.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Questions to Mr. Johnson on the mechanics of the bill before we get into the advocacy and opposition?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. I'm going to have to leave at 2:30 today, so I just want to get a couple questions in. Mr. Johnson, is there precedent for the automatic adjustment clause? That just didn't come out of thin air. We didn't make that up, did we?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, no, there is an automatic adjustment clause. There is precedent for that. In fact, it is a term that has in existing law. You will see it there in lines on page 5, lines 10 through 15, in the light face. That is existing law. And really all we're doing is adding the words taxes actually paid to that definition.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make that clear.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, and I'm representing industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. Well, IGNU, as we're known, really appreciates the tremendous time and effort that's gone into by all parties to try to develop this draft. As many of you know that the previous draft dealt with consolidated and deconsolidated tax returns, and I think there was objections that were raised to that were somewhat legitimate in terms of concerns of segregating six utilities and treating them differently in the process. But the fact remains, I think we have a very unique opportunity here to correct what we believe is an injustice in terms of what's occurred over the years. Fundamentally, the premise that ratepayers should not be paying in their rates for taxes that weren't paid. And that the chair and many of the parties have worked very hard to try to put this draft together to address this in a way that reflects the actual reality of rate setting in this state so that it is not onerous either on the customers or on the utilities. We welcome this particular draft. We think it's excellent. It is going right in the direction that we want to go. We are continuing to work with council on I think in particular section 4 sub 1 that you find on the bottom of page 2 as to whether or not that particular section is really necessary based upon some of the other provisions that you find in particular subsection 4 sub 4. But again, we're continuing that conversation and that's going forward. In addition to that, on page 4, lines 18 through 21, the definition of material adverse effect, again, we want the opportunity to continue to discuss that with council as to how that should be worded and how the commission might deal with that particular situation. But we believe in that concept that you find in there as an exception. We think that should be there for the benefit of really both parties in this process. So we welcome the further discussions that we're going to have over the next day or two, and our understanding is that we'll be moving with the final draft on Tuesday, and assuming we, you know, that all these issues are discussed, we will be supporting the bill. But At this point, again, we want to commend the process and the draft that you have up to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Let's go to Mr. Bissonnette.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board. We have residential customers. There's not a whole lot I can add from the comments that Mr. Nelson just made. We, too, appreciate the opportunity to be involved in the process and to figure out how to effectively address a very important policy issue that has been vexing ratepayers now for a while, and so we want to make sure that there's something that is done that does protect ratepayers, but also at the same time something that makes it withstands legislative scrutiny, and we think that this is heading in the right direction, and we too look forward to continuing the conversation again over the next day or two, and we're hopeful that on Tuesday we'll have a bill that's ready to move.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Senator Starr.
Thank you. I want to have your comments on rate stability. Could you comment on this bill as it relates to rate stability and the effect that some years utilities may be highly profitable and in that case their taxes go up, and in that case they have some sort of opportunity that they do their tax report and basically, they say that they'll have to pay more in taxes. Do they then have the opportunity to have their rates go up to cover that cost? The other side of the coin is, they come to a situation where, for whatever reason, their costs go the other way. Doesn't that affect the stability of the rates overall, and that part of the process of having the PUC regulate the utilities is to at least have some stability in the rates, at least for the period of time that the rate case under which the utility is regulated is there?
I'm starting to follow you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, rate stability is important, but there are a variety of instances where there are rate adjustments and cost adjustments between rate cases, and so what we're trying to set up is a process where there is some ability to look at the tax issue on an ongoing basis, and there's a symmetry there. Sometimes if there's risk that's taken by the ratepayer, there's times that risks are taken by the shareholder, and what we're trying to do is figure out a mechanism to make sure that what's collected in rates specifically for taxes actually makes it to the tax authority, which hasn't been happening. As I think Senator Metzger and Senator Walker have discovered, it's a complex process, and we're trying to get something that is not to use too much of a cliched phrase, but a fair and balanced process on how to get there. So yes, it is important that rate stability is a driving factor in this, but at the same time, we need to make sure that people have confidence that the taxes that are part of rates make it to the taxing authority for which those taxes are intended.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I would concur in that and just add, rates decrease or change every year, and as for a variety of factors, and one of those factors certainly has been the taxes allegedly owed by the utility, and in many cases not paid. In 2004, in the rate case that we're doing right now, before the PUC, a Pacific Core rate case, we just had testimony entered that Pacific Core is charging about $27 million for 2004 for tax taxes that were never paid. So that too impacts the rates, and we believe with a three-year language in there that you're going to be able to see some leveling out. One, we won't be paying taxes that were never paid in our rates, but we will see some consistency that will come based upon how this has been drafted.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stand by. Mr. Meek. Dan Meek, please. With regulating books in hand, it looks like. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dan Meek. I'm a PGE ratepayer, and I'm an attorney representing the Utility Reform Project. To put this in context, the major regulated energy utilities in Oregon appear to be currently charging ratepayers significantly over $100 million a year for income, just for income taxes that those utilities are in fact not paying to any taxing authority. PGE alone is charging $93 million to ratepayers for that purpose, and since 1997 has charged ratepayers over $750 million on their electric bills, supposedly for state and federal income taxes, but in fact that amount has not been paid by PGE or by Enron to any government authority. I think the legislature should ban this practice immediately. These amendments are the result of substantial discussion over the past several weeks, and every provision in this current draft is needed in order to have an assured solution to this problem. I support the current draft, if it is not amended. And, however, of course, it's not perfect. Nothing is perfect, and there are a couple of problems with this draft. The first problem is that it needs deadlines for the annual report functions being required of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. As you're aware, the Public Utility Commission has resisted solving this problem for several years. I filed a complaint to the Public Utility Commission about this over 2 years ago, and it took an order of the Marion County Circuit Court to get the Public Utility Commission to even recognize this as a cognizable issue before the commission. So if you assign functions to the Public Utility Commission, they have to be assigned with deadlines. And the function of having this annual report and creating an automatic adjustment clause needs several deadlines. For example, the bill contains no deadline for requiring the first annual report. It contains no due date for the first annual report. And by the way, the first annual report, there's no reason that shouldn't cover the 3 years by itself. That is, the utilities certainly have their tax data for the past 3 years, so the first annual report should cover the past 3 years. There's also no deadline for the commission to review the report after it's submitted to the PUC. There's no deadline for the commission to make the determination on whether the utility has been charging ratepayers more for income taxes than it has actually paid. There is nothing in the bill that requires a prompt effective date for the automatic adjustment clause. It just says the PUC shall establish an automatic adjustment clause with an effective date of its choosing. The PUC could choose to set an effective date that is months or even years into the future. So I think the lack of statutory deadlines could allow this really indefensible practice to go on for years. In the current draft, however, Section 4, Subsection 1, makes the practice of charging ratepayers for taxes that the utilities don't actually pay unlawful from the outset, so that provision is absolutely necessary. The second, perhaps lesser problem, is the definition of tax contained in this bill. It defines tax as monetary charges by government, but only those going for, quote, general government operations. Well, what if there's a tax that applies to corporations generally, or including utilities, and the tax proceeds are specified for a particular purpose, such as schools? Does that mean the utility can charge that tax to ratepayers and then not actually remit those amounts to the taxing authority? I don't see any reason to limit the definition of tax to the monetary payments to government units that are only for, quote, general government operations. So I very much appreciate the work of the committee on this bill, and I hope that it proceeds, and it does need a little bit of tweaking, very minor, and I certainly would not be in a position to support this bill if it were significantly weakened.
Thank you, Mr. Meek. Questions? Okay, thank you. Okay, let's ask Pamela Lesh, Scott Bolton, and Gary Bauer to come forward.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for giving us some time to address you today. I'm going to start off, and then my two colleagues will come in and join me. And for the record, I'm Pamela Lesh, Vice President for Regulatory Affairs for Portland General Electric Company. We did come prepared today to address the Dash 6 amendments that we got yesterday, and I would still like to do that, but let me start off by expressing some confusion over the Dash 7 amendments. As described by Legislative Council, it appeared that it was a one-way true-up in the taxes, that there would be a refund to customers if the taxes were less than what was estimated in the utilities test year, but there would not be a charge to customers if the taxes were more than what was estimated in the test year. We would have significant concerns about a one-way only adjustment clause, and that would be unprecedented. Adjustment clauses that track either changes in costs or changes in revenues for utilities are traditionally, and I think probably under constitutional law, two-way. They track the changes up, the changes down. It's done for a policy by the commission, and we are not aware of any instance where it's ever one-way. But as I said, it's unclear. The answers given by the panelists shortly after the amendments were explained seem to indicate that the changes would be two-way, and the material adverse effect clause seems to suggest charges to customers as well. So let me note for the record, we're confused, and if that gets clear, we'll probably have some more to say on the subject. So let me talk about the true-up generally, because that is what we wanted to do today now that the bill has surfaced with that provision. And what I've put together is some examples just to tell you the practical effects of a true-up. And then I do have a suggestion in concept for how we might limit some of these practical effects. And I see that Teresa is getting that to you. We drew these examples from our last general rate case. So in general terms, the numbers are right, but I rounded and got rid of unnecessary dollars and cents that were simply confusing. So let me just orient you for a moment to a base picture where we, Portland General Electric, have $1.5 billion in revenue that's approved to be modeled into rates. We have operating expenses without taxes of about $1.275 billion. Taxes are $75, so total expenses are $1,350, and that gives us an operating income of $150. And so the income taxes are due on that $150. That's the base case. Now, I'm going to have you turn the page.
Question?
Sure.
Of course. So if you had an operating income of $150 for this particular year, what would have been your tax that you would have paid?
$75 million.
$75 million.
That's what it's assumed.
So, okay. So where do we get into this $10 business? Just for the record, to clarify.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Moynihan Anderson, the $10, that's currently Oregon's minimum corporate tax payment that must be paid regardless what your tax return says, and the federal government has something similar for individuals. I believe it's called the alternative minimum tax. So that is the payment that was made by Enron as a result of the consolidation of all the positive income and negative income among the corporate family, and the resulting income tax owed being nothing. So the minimum kicks in. So in this first scenario, let's assume this was 2002. We last did a general rate case in 2001, so this could easily have been 2002. What we assumed was that it was a cold winter. Now, we haven't seen one of those for quite some time, but you never know, it could happen. So customers have paid us more revenue than we expected when we set rates. And that does happen from time to time. So you can see that the revenue line went up, and we assumed that at an average rate of 7.5 cents a kilowatt hour. Now, our operating expenses would also have gone up because we would have had to buy that power to sell to customers. And so there would have been more power than we assumed in the rate case. And we assumed that that cost us about 5 cents. So our expenses didn't go up as much as our revenue. That means that we had more operating income, and you can see it was just a little over $13 million higher, and we had more income taxes. With a total true-up of the taxes, customers would now owe us another $8.8 million. Unfortunately, it doesn't stop there because that increases our income. That increases our taxes, and so there would be another increment owed. We iterated that through to produce this example for you, and that is the $5.3 million. So in total, for that year that had a cold winter, meaning customers' bills were already higher, customers would owe us another $14 million. In the next example, we worked with the cost side rather than the revenue side. And we see changes all the time in both sides. Nothing is ever as quite as we assumed it in the rate case. And we all expect that and that know that we're just trying to get it as close as possible. This is an example that we also haven't seen for some time, but we are hopeful. We have assumed there was lots of rainfall and that there's good snowpack in the mountains, and our hydro projects produce more power than we expected. That power is worth on the market, say, 5 cents. So what has happened is our revenue line is the same, but our costs went down significantly because we were able to sell off that power, and that gets netted against our costs. Our income taxes are now higher by $17.5 million, and that's the effect of that $44 million reduction in the expenses. So our operating income is higher by about $25 million, but we go back again, the true-up on taxes, if it is going through to customers, I mean, customers have to contribute another $17.5 million, and iterated through, it comes up to a total of $28 million. The last example, I also worked with the cost side, just to take you through something that shows a higher cost to the utility. We do experience higher costs, and unlike the prior two examples, that's happened with fairly great regularity, at least recently. So here the revenue stays the same, but our operating expenses go up $15 million. And this indicates that would be a common cost increase for employee benefit costs, and I know you've heard about that in many other forums. That cost increase lowers our income tax bill by about $6 million. Tax policy offsets part of the cost increases we see, and it also mitigates the income effects of greater revenues. So our expenses are up, our operating income is down, and we now owe customers a refund, even though we have lower operating income, of $6 million. And by the time we iterate that through, we owe another $3.6 million. So we have to give customers back $9.6 million because of the $9 million cost increase that we experienced in providing them service. Those are just pretty general examples of what could easily happen with the true-up approach. Conceptually, if the commission not only tracks the tax changes, but the underlying cost and revenue changes that have caused that tax to change, then you can offset the two effects and you can make everything match again. Right now you have costs and benefits totally disconnected. If the utility is benefiting, customers are paying a cost. And if the customers are benefiting, it's because the utility is paying a cost. You can realign them by having at least a partial tracking of those underlying changes in the costs and revenues. And we started work this morning on language that would attempt to do that. That would not address in any circumstance the other issue of a corporate family and changes in the income that relate to that corporate family that never had costs or revenues reflected
in the utilities rates at all. But it would at least prevent this perverse result from happening with respect to utility costs of service. And, of course, then probably help preserve our credit ratings and enable us to continue to raise money on behalf of customers. And should the Dash 7 amendments actually be two-way, prevent customers from paying higher costs simply because of this approach to handling the issue that everyone has spoken to, which is of the combined effects of shareholder losses in other ventures with utilities income. Thank you.
I'm just because of time, Senator Marsan, can I go to the other two panelists first? Scott, you want to?
Thank you, Chair Metzger. For the record, my name is Scott Bolton. I represent Pacific Corp. Very simply, Senate Bill 408 will hurt ratepayers and hurt utilities. And in the most simplest explanation, it's because this bill will erode the will erode the fundamental regulatory ring fencing that the Oregon Public Utility Commission and 41 other state public service or public utility commissions have employed for years. Ratepayers would pay more if the consolidated group is profitable. Section 4 of this bill says that if a public utility's actual taxes are more than estimated, the PUC shall adjust the rates of the utility to recover with interest any amount of tax actually paid that is greater than the estimated amount of taxes. Income taxes generally are tied to profits. Actual taxes generally will exceed estimated taxes if the consolidated group is more profitable than anticipated. The results of this can be Oregon ratepayers would pay more because profits earned by affiliates, even those in other states, regardless of the cost of providing electric utility service, would occur.
I've got to interrupt you right there. Because on page 3, I think you're reading about the taxes. It's talking about the affiliated group that is properly attributed to the utility, not the consolidated other affiliates that you're referring to.
So, I mean, I'm not sure I understand.
If you see the line, do you have the amendment?
Yes,
page 3?
Yes.
Lines 12 through 15, the amount of taxes paid by the utility in the previous fiscal year, that was paid by the affiliated group, and that is properly attributed to the utility. You're talking about hurting taxpayers because of other non-affiliated groups, but these are the taxes that are only attributed to that utility, even if they are part of a consolidated group.
So then the effect of this amendment, Chair Metzger, if I may ask a question, is that the Oregon Department of Revenue will no longer collect any taxes attributed to a consolidated group that has a utility affiliate?
No. What it means is, in adjusting the rates for taxes, that when they file the report with the commission, it will be those taxes which are attributable only to the operations of that utility, even if you have multiple other affiliates. I mean, that's going to have to be figured in the tax report that, in this case, PacifiCorp would have to file, is to then break that down.
Sorry. Mr. Chairman, if I could ask a question, would that work for the losses then as well? If the other corporations had losses and those are offset, would this tax report...
It has nothing to do with other corporations. It's only the utility itself. No other affiliations are affected by this. It would be your responsibility to delineate the utility in filing the report with the PUC, what their actual costs were, what their taxes are. It has nothing to do with any other affiliates you have. And that would be your responsibilities to have to extract that cost, just like you did in your scenarios, but to actually be able to do that. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to bring that out.
That's fine. This is a good discussion, Senator Metzger. I guess our thoughts on this would be is that it's very unclear as Oregon taxpayers what our responsibility would be under the current consolidated tax rules with the Dash 7 amendments.
Well, you can consolidate all you want. It's that you're not going to be allowed to collect other than the taxes that you owe in this particular, in this case, in the rates that you're collecting for the operation of actually that utility. File anywhere you want. I'll go to Mr. Bauer, and then I have questions, and then Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. Appreciate the opportunity to appear this afternoon. Northwest Natural does not have a holding company, so we don't have the same issues as you were just discussing, but we do file our returns, and we do have various tax treatments that we take, and one of those in particular is the issue of accelerated depreciation. We just completed our largest capital project last year, and that had a definite effect on taxes. Mm-hmm. If I can just step back for a second, though, as we talked about the rate process earlier, when you do those, you basically develop a test year, take 12 months, and you, I'm going to oversimplify this, but you look at all your costs, and out of that, I think, as the commission has testified on your previous discussions, they then determine the tax liability from that. And then they basically say, okay, here's the amount of money you can charge per therm or per kilowatt hour as a utility. As you go forward, figuring out then how you address all of those costs for that amount of money. And so it's not that they identify X number of cents for taxes, X number of cents for the cost of gasoline, X number of cents for doing some other activity, because they know that there's going to be changes. It's a test year. It's just a snapshot in time in which they use to develop what that rate will be. And so I think that's one of the concerns we're trying to raise, is that as you go forward, the tax, you're trying to manage your company as best you can to all of those. Your taxes are directly affected by all of the other costs that were in that rate case. So if those costs go up, it will definitely lower the tax liability. In the end, you still only get so many cents per therm or kilowatt hour, though, to try to manage all of those costs. I use one as an example that's been frustrating us recently, is that as utilities are required to relocate their facilities when a governmental entity asks us to do that, and we do that, quote, free of charge. As development grows, that's also becoming one of our increasing expenses that we're not sure how to estimate, because we will go into a rate case, we'll put an amount in the process, but we don't know the next year if there's a large, say, Bridgeport Village or something like that that may cost us, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars that we didn't anticipate. There's no way to recoup those, yet those costs may well affect the tax rate and may cause the tax rate to go down. So I think that's what we're trying to just comment on that a little bit. The other couple of quick things, if this does go in the way it is, one of the things that utilities do is we will use the Energy Business Tax Credit. We've used that to work with various entities, Washington County and others, to try to do some alternative energy activities. We've put in distributed generation systems. If this goes into effect, there's no reason at all for us to basically take their tax liability. We basically buy their tax liability, and so it's kind of a wash, but you're helping those customers move further along the path of finding alternative resources. There's just no incentive, and in fact it would cost us twice if we did that going forward. And then I know you're short on time. I've asked a number of our folks to look at the earlier version, but I think the language is still the same on page 4 when they try to cover in lines 5 through 10 the discussion about deferred tax. And I got 4 different answers, so I'll use my simple way of looking at this, which is, in the first sentence it reads to me that the commission may authorize a utility to include in rates deferred taxes. And then the last sentence in that paragraph says deferred taxes that are paid may not be charged to ratepayers. It may just be a terminology issue. It may not. It may be triggering off of something else, but
I believe it was to eliminate the double counting of when you put them in and then you take them out.
And for the people, for those of us who thought this was taking care of exactly what we do today, thought that was the case, someone else came back and said, "But you've got deferred taxes in and deferred taxes not in." And so, again, I think confusion.
We'll look at that.
And with that, I'll just stop and answer your questions.
Senator Monsanto, we had a question.
I think if you want testimony, I can wait.
Okay, I think what I'd like to do, because what I'll do, thank you very much. Yes, Senator Starr, you may.
Very kind of 10,000-foot level question. Isn't there an underlying issue of fairness here that this committee and this legislature, I think, is trying to get at, that if utilities have the opportunity to put taxes in their rates, and for whatever reason, based on, you know, your examples, somehow don't pay those taxes, isn't there some underlying, just on its face, something unfair about that particular issue?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Starr, if the taxes were different because the costs of revenues were different, I don't think so. If we did a mini rate case to reflect what we then knew were going to be the costs or going to be the revenues, the tax number would have changed. We don't do rate cases all the time, and so we all live with the assumptions until we do the next rate case, when everything is internally consistent, so the taxes relate to the revenues that have been estimated as well as all the costs. So within that context, fairness is actually interrupted if you say, no, we'll pluck out this effect of the changes in costs and revenues, which is the taxes, and we'll treat that differently than the underlying costs and revenues themselves. We think that doesn't work, and will actually, it either exacerbates losses the utility is already seeing or gains the utility is already making. You will find returns varying much more widely than you would have had you left taxes alone, because taxes act as a damper on those changes. If it's a cost, taxes, frankly, the feds absorb part of the cost increase. If it's a revenue increase, the feds get part of it, as does the state. So it's a damper on the effects on us.
Ratepayers would think they're the ones that are the damper that's being applied. Thank you very much. I appreciate this very much. We are running short of time. I'm going to ask Melinda Davison to come forward for a moment. And welcome. State your name for the record, and you've been back there listening to the scenarios that were presented. If you identify who you are, who you represent, and I would be curious because of your reaction to the scenarios that were presented to us here.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. My name is Melinda Davison, and I'm an attorney for the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. I do have a reaction to the scenarios that were handed out by Portland General Electric. I would say there's a couple of things that are immediately come to mind. The examples that you have in front of you assume that PGE is a standalone utility and is not owned by Enron. And we know that the reason why we're here today is because that's not the case. And so what is missing from these examples is the Enron impact, which is that year after year after year, Enron is paying zero for the various tax, income tax scenarios that PGE has listed here. That is the crux of the problem. So while these examples may be interesting, I would submit that they're irrelevant because they do not reflect the Enron aspect of it. And I would just add to that, in response to what Ms. Lesh just said about the fairness question, the fundamental problem that we have is that Ms. Lesh is absolutely right, that for most aspects of rate making, if PGE comes in, files a rate case, and you see for 5 years that ratepayers have been paying a cost, let's say it's $10 million, and that for 5 years the actual cost has been zero. When you set the new rates on a going forward basis, you would then put zero in, not the $10 million that we've been paying. And the income taxes is just a glaring discrepancy or exception to that rule, and that's why we believe that there does need to be a legislative change to fix that problem.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Marsden.
Yeah, but then really there is a disincentive for corporations to want to have expansions or be affiliated with utilities within Oregon. I mean, is the amount of tax, would that be so significant that Pacific Core wouldn't want to do business in Oregon? Do you see where I'm going with this?
Yes, Senator, and I do not believe that this bill will create that kind of disincentive. I think that what this bill is trying to do is take away the incentive to collect all of these dollars and have those extra dollars going to shareholders that are never paid to a taxing authority. I don't believe, and certainly we're very open to having discussions with the utilities, that this has created some unintended consequences, because I don't believe that, as written, that this would create that kind of disincentive, and it's certainly not the intent.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. See, Mr. Lindbergh had walked into the room. Do you guys want to talk about utility taxes by chance? Before we conclude, I'm going to ask Mr. Shepard to come forward, and I apologize for all of you who I've been calling up who hadn't signed up. But Mr. Shepard from the Attorney General's office was involved in the discussion so that we had. If you identify yourself for the record, I'm curious if the Attorney General has taken a position on this issue at this point at all.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. We have appreciated the Chair's invitation to participate to an extent in the work group, and we're interested in the progress that's being made. Are you asking me whether there is whether we have anything to offer the committee about the constitutional limitations?
No, I'm just curious about on this issue that we're dealing with. I know your office has been talking about this, and I would be curious, and the committee would be curious as to whether the Attorney General's office is forming an opinion on this issue.
Yes, I've consulted with the Attorney General, and Attorney General Myers would like to see the law move in a direction that more closely connects the actual taxes received by governments to the amounts that utilities are recovering as that element of their costs. And that needs to proceed within there are some constitutional limitations on this body's authority to achieve that policy goal. And those are real limitations and need to be taken into account. And in addition, we're very much aware that the Department of Justice doesn't have specialized expertise to help this committee answer the kind of question that Senator Montes Anderson was addressing to the previous witness, namely, what are the economic consequences in the marketplace of these decisions? But as a general principle, Attorney General Myers does believe that the law ought to be moved in the direction that you are interested in trying to steer.
Thank you, Mr. Shipp, and thank you for your counsel too as well. My final person I'd like to ask up is Associated Oregon Industries. Yeah. And if you're in the room, you might get called up too. So if you don't, you can escape now. Ms. Brandis, if you just identify yourself for the record and just kind of, and things have been moving late at night, early morning, but I think the committee would be interested of where maybe AOI may be at this moment and what we might expect to hear in the future from Associated Oregon Industries on this issue.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. The last time our Energy Committee had an opportunity to take a look at the issue before you was a couple weeks ago. It was a different bill. I think our committee, if I could articulate it, reflected, they took a neutral position. I think there was a group of our members who evidently felt very strongly towards the question that Senator Starr asked. There's a certain element of fairness that is involved if you are collecting taxes, if a company is indeed collecting taxes but not paying taxes. There was another element, and actually a very strong element within the committee, excuse me, who felt the initial proposal that they looked at would be awkward for a broad-based business organization to take a position on it. What right would they have to sort of come down and say some types of companies can indeed follow, file consolidated tax forms while others cannot? So they ended up taking a neutral position. This is a different proposal. I'd be willing to ship it to them over the Memorial Day weekend and see if I can get some response or a call together.
That would be appreciated. Thank you very much. Okay, just to let everybody know, we will be meeting at 1 o'clock on Tuesday. We'll have this bill for work session at that time. I think the information that was conveyed in the hearing was very, very helpful, and there'll be some modifications. I don't think a lot of modifications, but they could be significant ones in terms of the impact. I mean, on some things, I thought there's some good information that was brought forth today, and we'll have that bill back, and we'll also then, members, we will try and conclude our business on Tuesday. If not, we can come back on Thursday, but the goal will be this committee will conclude its business on Tuesday, and I appreciate you guys being very, very attentive and everything. So with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 408, and we'll adjourn the committee. Thank you.